Adam has led a professional life in protecting and studying coral reefs in Hawaii and throughout the Pacific his entire 40 years of coral reef research.
So as listeners that keep up with us, realize that we've been trying to interview Kupuna within our community that are willing to share their experiences and understanding of our aquatic resources here on Kauai and in Hawaiian Islands. Jim is a Kupuna from the culture that Don and I come from, of science and the professional biology realm. And so we're just so fortunate that he now resides here on Kauai and has been willing to come in and share his experiences in Manao that he's gathered over his the years that he's worked here in Hawaii. And Jim has spent an enormous amount of time in the waters in and around Hawaii and has gathered a lot of data that we use today in conservation and regulatory realm, and he's developed a unique perspective from that from the time he spent in the water. And again, we're just so thankful that he's willing to come in and share these experiences. So, Jim, if you don't mind, even though you're a resident now here of Kauai, can you tell us where you grew up and how you came to spend so much time in Hawaiian waters?
Well, that's pretty easy. In 1965, I was 21, and it was the end of my junior year. And I came to Hawaii for vacation, and I loved the place and the people especially. This was August of 1965. And I got on the plane and went back to Los Angeles, and South Los Angeles was up in smoke. It was the time of the first Watts riot. And that was sort of a clue to me that maybe I need to get out of Dodge and go to Hawaii and study coral reefs. And the other part of this story is that I learned about coral reefs when I was at UCLA on my sophomore year. I had to take an exam in Zoology 101B, and I went to the library to look at all the references, and pre-med students had stolen all of the required readings, but there was one optional reading called Atolls. And it was written by the professor, and I just got totally enamored by this. And the other thing that happened, when I was 10, I lived near the beach in Belmont Shore, and I also had the opportunity to get a book from a friend of mine called The Sea Around Us that was produced by Rachel Carson.
Interesting.
And also later it was a movie, and then of course Jacques Cousteau and his movies, all of that really helped me out.
So did you live near the beach? Were you a surfer and fisherman, or?
Well, I was only 8 to 10 years old, and yeah, basically I just got in the water. That was bad enough. Yeah. It was pretty cold there.
So this is really fascinating, because you truly come to us and your experience here from an academic perspective. It tripped your trigger from books.
Yes.
Very cool. Very cool.
Jim, I realize that I've known you for a little over 31 years. When I first took the aquatic biologist position here on Kauai in June of 1981, you were doing the Hawaii Coastal Resource Atlas and mapping all the coral reefs in the main Hawaiian island at that time.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite projects, and actually most useful, because it was more than just going out there and collecting data. We brought in kupunas from all the different islands in the Pacific, and I think the best example of that was at Palau. We had a big rapid ecological assessment, and we flew aerial photographs of the entire archipelago and then put a mosaic on a table that was maybe 50 feet long, and then invited the equivalent of kupunas from Palau to come into the room and tell us which places they feel are important. And then we, over the next 2 years, we went out there and did surveys. And this formed the basis of establishing protected areas in Palau. And the same sort of philosophy applied to the Hawaiian atlases and inventory reports. We went around and talked to people and found out what kind of activities were going on at each place, And if you look at the atlases, you'll see that there's symbols showing what the importance of each of these places were.
Just for our listening audience, there's copies of the Kauai Coastal Resource Atlas that Jim did in the Kapaa Library, Volumes 1 and 2.
And there's also, there's one at Princeville Library, the atlas.
So let's go back. So you came out to Hawaii in the early 60s?
January 67.
67. To go to graduate school at the University of Hawaii.
University of Hawaii Department of Oceanography.
Yeah. And you were telling us earlier about the project that you did for your research and kind of why you did it. And I think it's kind of unique because your career spans the implementation of a lot of environmental law and practices in Hawaii.
Yes, so I wanted to work on Kaneohe Bay, the marine lab there, and I guess it really motivated me. They had a bunch of engineers do a big, huge survey of Kaneohe Bay in, I think, 1968. I won't mention any names, but they basically hung instruments over the side and came to the conclusion that the bay was fine. And in my case, I basically went underwater and I was doing surveys and realized that the bay wasn't okay, that the reefs looked to me that were degrading. And so I established a fairly sophisticated program to transplant corals and use them as environmental indicators throughout the bay and survey the reefs everywhere in the bay. And as a result, after 3 years of research in 1972, I concluded indeed and actually provided the evidence that the bay was being, the coral reefs in the bay were declining. And so mission accomplished. I got my PhD and didn't worry about it anymore. Hoped that the government would do the right thing. And I actually talked to them. And then 7 years later, they actually removed the sewer outfalls outside of Kaneohe Bay and put them off Mokapu in deeper water, where the water quality is better because the residence time of the water is faster. And since that time, I've had three sets of graduate students go back to my study sites. So I got my PhD in 72, and then there was a group that came in 1983, another one in 1997, and one this year. It's going back to resurvey my sites and others and see how Kaneohe Bay is doing.
And?
It's hard to tell. A lot of people live around the bay. We got, aside from getting the sewer outfalls outside the bay, we still have septic tanks, mm-hmm. and cesspools that were grandfathered, and we just have more people.
That's right. You've probably almost tripled in your population in Kaneohe Bay since 1972, for sure.
And then, of course, we've got alien species that were established in there, and we've got freshwater floods. It's really hard. There's a lot of things happening in Kaneohe Bay, and it's really hard to get a handle on it.
But had they not moved the outfall,
it would be ugly.
It would be ugly, right.
You know, there's an old saying that the S blank 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 runs downhill. And what Jim just discussed in especially in South Kaneohe Bay, with all the sewage outfall in the early 60s. The trade winds were blowing that all into the southern part of the bay. It had nowhere to go, nowhere to dilute or escape, and it just started killing coral reefs. We have, to a lesser degree, that problem right in Nawiliwili Bay, where we have concentrated sewage, a plant that periodically has a valve break and sewage spills into the bay.
Yeah, well, in my case, when you're 25, you're fearless. So I went to every possible place in the bay to do surveys, and they got staph infections on my leg, and I just kind of blew it off, never went to the doctor. And then 40 years later, I got another staph infection right on my same leg, and I realized that this is serious stuff, and actually had to go to the hospital for 2 days, 40 years later, to get this fixed.
Wow.
And so...
So were you diving at the sewage outfalls?
Yeah, I was diving everywhere in the bay.
Dude,
I said, somebody's got to do it.
Wow.
We have people surfing in close to sewage outfalls right now.
Well, plus, it was sort of treated.
Yeah.
But when the power went off, There was no treatment.
Right.
And that still goes on in Kaneohe Bay.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's not ever going to be over.
Yeah.
And now Willy Willy.
Yeah. So so you get your PhD and establish a resource for students for decades now to follow up on and try to attempt to document the changes in the bay. Yeah.
Yeah, students are the next generation.
Yeah, the next generation. And then after you got your PhD, you continued working in Hawaii.
Yes. I had a postdoc at the University of Hawaii using transplanted corals, using them to help reestablish coral reefs. And then after that, I became the chief of the environmental branch for the Army Corps of Engineers for the Pacific region, which extended from Hawaii all the way to Japan and Korea. And I had that job for 15 years. And it was right at the time when the National Environmental Policy Act, the act that established the need for environmental impact statements, was started. And so it was a real struggle to get a lot of engineers. Basically, I was at a branch of about no more than 10 people dealing with about 1,000, a sea of engineers, let's say. So it took a while to work together in a harmonious way, but there was some battles. There's no way to get around it, but it was a great experience for me. And it takes a lot of effort to try to do these studies. And in a sense, when you're doing environmental impact statements, you're going to somehow degrade the environment. But I helped to establish a good program there and protected many reefs over the 15-year period that I worked there.
I think a lot of people, and I've been fortunate to have the breadth of my career to be involved in the NEPA review process also. And I think a lot of people don't understand that NEPA was established as a decision-making process, right? So that federal agencies who are going to do a project that's going to impact, it helps supposed to help guide their decision-making process.
That's right.
To minimize negative environmental impacts, correct?
And the main part of that thing, which sometimes is not understood, is looking at alternatives.
Right.
That is the key, that's the heart of the environmental impact process, and to figure out ways to minimize impacts and distinguish between impacts that cannot be
avoided
with those that can be.
Right.
And that's what's great about that. In fact, I wrote a book with Richard Carpenter about EIA.
Yeah.
Jim, if we looked at the impacts of human sewage on coral reefs from Kaneohe Bay to West Maui to Na Willy Willy Bay on Kauai, what kind of technologies could we integrate to lessen those impacts? Assuming that people will become more and more abundant in the future.
Well, the main thing people have to understand is we are going to continue to create sewage. It's going to be different times. So different kinds. And so one aspect, if you have to discharge it in the ocean, move the outfalls as far off and as deep as you can so that it can be diluted and not affect ecosystem near shore that would be impacted by the sewage, such as coral reefs. And that is certainly, it's an expensive option, especially in Hawaii, because the slopes of the reefs drop off pretty quickly. But that is probably the best solution, and that way, and then in terms of cost of trying to maintain sewage treatment plants, it's very expensive, and if you can just get the outfalls further offshore, do the initial studies and current regimes and everything, and that's really the easiest way. Now, on the other hand, sometimes it isn't. There are other options available, and so we need to be looking at composting and somehow recycling methane. There's lots of options available, but in a small island like this where you have limited land, the outfalls are usually probably the only option really that are feasible. You got to get it away from the people, but you also need to get it away from the reefs and other wetlands and other places that have value, and beaches, of course.
Well, another option that they're using are injection wells, and I think we talked about this earlier about some of your observations like on Maui, where they have utilized injection wells.
Well, that's really a joke from my standpoint. If you only had 10 people using the injection wells,
right,
you wouldn't have a problem. But the first law of the thermodynamics is it's got to go somewhere. It's, okay. And if you have injection wells on the island, eventually this stuff has got to go somewhere. It's an island. It's not a continent. It's going to come out at the shoreline. And that's exactly what happened. And there's been lots of money and wasted on trying to prove that this is not happening. Well, it's got to go somewhere. Right. It doesn't disappear. And so the solution here was to put an outfall rather than offshore. It's not possible to ever expect injection wells to solve your problem, especially if you're just going to keep having more and more injection wells, more hotels. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, we've got, I think, abundant data to show that it's not working, especially in West Maui. There's been researchers at NOAA Fisheries in Honolulu that have even correlated these fibropapilloma tumors with sewage outfalls into turtle populations that are near sewage outfall, especially injection well, and where they find a abnormal balance of amino acids in the seaweeds that those turtles are eating. And I'm not Kauai hasn't been studied under using that methodology, but we're hoping that that'll happen soon.
Yeah, aside from people as well as turtles and fish, who knows what kind of impacts are going on with the fish. So there has to be some treatment, but if you can get it further away from the sensitive ecosystem, like sea turtles, for example, they're primarily focused on shorelines.
That's right.
And in shallow waters. So if you can get the outfall in a position where it goes offshore, the plumes go offshore and they're deep enough so the turtles aren't going to go down there and graze on the
right.
On the pipes, then you're going to be much better off.
And do so before municipalities or agencies make the commitment and invest the infrastructure and time to establish a system that is not going to work very well.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is a system called a living system. It's got other name that uses bioengineering to treat sewage, where they use constructed wetlands and wetland plants. And in doing so, you convert those, quote, human wastes into plant living systems that are producing oxygen, consuming carbon dioxide. One of the most pressing living systems was integrated into Hershey's chocolate factory in Pennsylvania. They were getting $100,000 plus fines every year from EPA for discharging all of this wash water that was laden with suspended solids from all their chocolate processing. And this guy named Jack Todd, who designed the living system, came in and said, look it, I'll build that for less than your annual fines. And in doing so, you can reuse all your water. You won't get fines from EPA anymore, and you'll have this beautiful living wetland. And they did it. Not only was it a success, they didn't expect that it would now become like a living aquatic park in the middle of this industrialized Pennsylvania. People actually walk a half mile with their lunch to eat lunch there because there's butterflies and birds and plants and flowers, and it's a nice place to be.
In some cases, though, there's one extra step that needs to be done. In wetlands, they may need to be harvested because all this pollution is going to be taken up into the plants and they're going to clog the system. So,
that's right.
So there has to be a maintenance program to maintain the water, not only the water quality, but the amount
biomass,
of open areas in the marsh and use that in some positive way.
Maybe that's right.
To burn it or make compost out of it. So there's definitely more to it than just putting it in a wetland. The wetland itself is going to be affected by it, and you're going to have to do some follow-up on that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Jim. In most of those systems, the end product is water hyacinths. Those are dried, mulched, used for mulch, fertilizer. You're recovering the nutrients and putting them back onto farmlands where you can retain the sustainable agriculture and productivity of those soils by adding those those that organic matter constantly.
So, Jim, your career has spanned the conception of many of our environmental laws, like NEPA and the Endangered Species Act, so forth. When you were, you know, in a regulatory seat, yeah, and how those changed the culture of the agencies that we've all worked for. And you had shared some stories about the difficulty that agencies had with dealing with that change. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I had a difficulty with my thesis committee.
Right.
They wanted me to do some ivory tower nonsense. I said, no, I'm going to do something here that's going to make a difference.
Right.
And I had one of my mentors was Robert Johannes, and he helped to convince my committee to have me do an applied type of research in Kaneohe Bay. And, yeah, I did have some big battles with the government during my tenure at the Army Corps of Engineers.
While you were – but that was your job. You told the story about H3.
Yes, H3.
Yeah.
H3 was probably a turning point in my career. It was – December of 1980, I'm reading, minding my own business and reading the Sunday newspaper, and right down at the bottom it says, the H3 highway project has been approved by the Secretary of Transportation and the Governor of Hawaii. And at that time, we had a Ho'omaluhia, a beautiful park in Kaneohe, which this highway is going to wrap around it. And I said, well, what happened here? We didn't get any EIS. So I called up the state guys, the federal guys, and the federal guy had the nerve to tell me, I'm sorry, we do not solicit public comments of final EISs. Well, I said, well, what about the draft? And so I just read him the riot act. I said, you know, according to 40 CFR 1508.11 or whatever it was, we have 30 days to review your EIS, but plus we are a cooperating agency and not the public. And there was dead silence at the end of the line. And I didn't know until later on that they had not done an EIS. They took the 1976 EIS, took the cover off, and put 1980 on it. And so the gig was up. And when I got the EIS back, it hadn't changed from 1976 at all. Duh. So I had to go to my colonel and said, we must submit federal review comments on the CIS. And so I was responsible for that. And at the time, I had a great colonel. It was a district engineer, administrator. He sent the comments on the last day, the 30-day period. And the very next day, the U.S. attorney for Hawaii, which is in the Department of Justice, calls up
your supervisor. No,
the district engineer, yeah, and asked him to withdraw the letter of comment, which is in the department, which is in the executive branch.
That sounds illegal, Jim.
Well, and so of course he declined to do that. He was smart
Good
enough.
For him.
Because
that was your agency's job.
Yes.
Right.
And he backed me up, and so the S hit the fan after that. We're talking about a billion dollar project, and I'm just trying to do my job, but got a lot of heat for exposing this.
But if they would have had their way, it would have been moved through on a Sunday afternoon, right? With no review.
Because nobody would have read it, but right. Jim read it.
Right.
And I figured out what happened. It was between the Carter administration and the
Reagan
administration. Yeah. He only had 2.5 months or whatever.
And they just tried,
when Carter lost the election, then they got worried and tried to sneak that EIS through the system.
All that's still going on.
Just read the paper and say.
So even though you were in the position where those documents were supposed to land on your desk, you had to find out about it in the paper.
Yes.
So unbelievable. That some things never change.
Well, you should go look at the park there. Ho'omaluhia, beautiful
park.
It is.
I've been there.
And and I helped save it, so to speak.
See, well, this is
we're
this,
so fortunate that we've got heroes like you that have worked in our government systems.
Well, you know, what you just explained is still going on today.
Sure.
It's going on as we speak. And we're still stuck in this old paradigm that it's the environmental tree huggers versus the developers and jobs. Why can't we get on the same paradigm that we want sustainable development, sustainable jobs in perpetuity forever? Not something that lasts for 2 years and then it's all gone and everybody's unemployed. Why can't we get there?
Because it makes too much sense.
My mantra has always been to do the right thing.
Right.
And that's all there is to it. As simple as that.
Well, that's right in our state. It's in our state motto.
And you're right. And I think if we did that as individuals, then whatever group we're working with or for would have to do that. Yeah.
But we saw this with the proposed super fair here, you know, last year. It was circumventing Chapter 343, the environmental impact statement law, went all the way to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, Governor, you did the wrong thing. This was Governor Linda Lingle at the time.
That's a very sad thing because in reality, it would have been good to have a ferry system.
I agree.
I mean, if you go out and buy tickets from Hawaiian Air now, it's pretty hard.
That's right. And I actually wrote to Linda Lingle and said, instead of spending $100 million on this, give the Polynesian Voyaging Society $10 million. Let them build an inter-island voyaging canoe I'll buy the first 6 round trip tickets.
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, if they just done it right and went through the system and get the public involved, maybe we would have a ferry system. We'd have an option of flying between islands. So that's the really sad thing about doing it wrong.
Yep. I agree.
We it helped to eliminate a really
potentially good project.
A potentially good project, exactly.
Yeah.
But see, she's a good example. I'm not picking on you, Linda, but if here was an opportunity to do it right, go through the environmental review, come up with hopefully a sailing inter-island ferry system that uses renewable energy, listen to some good Hawaiian music on the way. Throw a hand line over the stern, catch a few mai-mai. Who wouldn't want to do that?
Yeah, and not whack, you know, dolphins.
Right.
And whales, if you're going 30 knots, speed, let's go slower.
Speed kills on the water just like it kills on land.
Yeah. And I think, you know, part of it goes back to an ignorance of the process within those people who are trying to initiate them.
The fear of the unknown, yes.
Well, it's the fear that following the process would most certainly kill the project, where it's the opposite is true, is that if they follow the process, which is just a decision-making process, the goal is not to stop it,
Make it sustainable, it more sustainable.
One of my mantras when I was chief of the environmental branch of the Army Corps of Engineers, I had to deal with 400 environmental assessments and impact statements during that 15-year period.
Wow.
None of them were ever stopped or challenged.
Yeah.
And that's because we did it the right way. We actually wrote the documents in our branch rather than the farm it out. But we obviously had a lot of people give us data.
Right.
And that was the reason why we had a good reputation.
That's significant. That statement's significant. Yeah. Over 400, all of them were approved because they went through rigorous review. Yeah. Comments and revisions and et cetera.
And yet you're a stinking coral hugger. Yet you went. But if the projects are reviewed and they take the recommendations to heart and can improve them to minimize the impact, the process can work.
Yeah, I don't take sides on the project. That's the important thing.
Right.
I only make sure that we're doing our job,
right,
properly, and let the public. And the administrations decide whether they're going to go forward with the project or not.
Right.
I mean, that's an important thing. We have to separate our responsibilities from our view,
your
heart. Personal views.
Yeah. Yep. So you wore a regulatory hat for several years, and then after that in your career, who did you work with?
Well, I became chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy part time, and then. Senior fellow in marine biology at the East-West Center. And so I was with the Nature Conservancy for 3 years, and I was shifting time. It was difficult to do both jobs, so eventually I went and spent more time at the East-West Center, and I stayed there through 1999. So, but I did some great things when I was with the Nature Conservancy, Palmyra Atoll. Mm-hmm. I at least started to establish it. This is a possibility to be protected. Some other projects, Solomon Islands, Palau, I mentioned that earlier about the Rapid Ecological Assessment of Palau. That was a two-year project involving 40 scientists, and that helped to establish several important protected areas in Palau. And then I moved to the East-West Center, as I mentioned.
And so most of that was looking at working on conservation efforts for coral reef systems?
Yes.
Throughout the Pacific.
And Asia as well.
In Asia.
And then after that, so in 1999, I took a job with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as their first coral reef biologist in the United States.
What year was that, Jim?
1999.
Yeah. Yeah, Jim, you know, we're kind of at a crossroads right now. We've got the Hawaii Coastal Zone Management Plan is now under review. The Hawaii Ocean Resources Management Plan is also under review. We've got a whale sanctuary that's kind of in limbo because the whales have increased by over 4,000%.
Yay.
That's a success. That's right, exactly success. What their protection was meant to do, to rebuild that once degraded population. But now we seem to have all of these agencies, NOAA Fisheries at the federal level, the sanctuary program at the state level. We've got many different departments, Department of Land and Natural Resources that I work for with our chairman, William Isla. Then we have all these different programs at the state, the Coastal Zone Management Program, et cetera. And we have the counties. And we're all looking at an old economy based on cheap fossil fuels that's now coming to an end. We have to build a new sustainable economy. We have to become food, fiber, and energy self-sufficient. How can we do this, Jim? You've got insight that we don't have. You've been professionally a federal biologist almost your entire professional career.
Well, at least 11 years. 11 out of 40.
Well, that's a lot. That's significant.
11 out of 40.
25%.
Well, that's right. 11 and 15. That's right. 26 years with the federal government.
Oh, 50%. There you go.
There we go. I think the main problem right now is that we got agencies at the federal level that are competing against one another. And to me, any time you spend time competing,
you're not cooperating.
You're wasting government money. Mm,
good point.
If you just work together instead of wasting time trying to say I'm better than you are and our way of doing things are better than yours, we're wasting government money, past taxpayers' money. And so I think it was a good idea for – I think Obama is talking about taking NOAA and putting a lot of NOAA back into the Department of Interior.
Where it once
we have one agency that's basically functioning – for conservation, and then have the rest of NOAA, which is under the Department of Commerce, I call it the Department of Money, is a disconnect here. And this has all happened because of the legislative branch decided this was a better way of establishing things. We need to figure out ways of streamlining the agencies we have so that their mission is not going to be schizophrenic. Such as NOAA. NOAA works for commerce, but at the same time, they're protecting things. They're protecting marine life, sanctuaries. And then you've also got marine fisheries, which is a commercial function. So it doesn't make sense. We need to have one agency focusing on,
conservation,
and the other one working on how to spend our money more wisely. And it doesn't. And I think that's the main thing at the federal level. I really don't know much about what's going on at the state and county level, but we all have all these different levels have different responsibilities. But just doing that, if you've got these obvious conflicts, it's time to maybe do some shifts again and go back to the way it was before.
Well, Jim, you were involved in the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands coral reef inventories way back in the early 80s, I think it was. And that was a tripartite agreement between NOAA Fisheries, Western Pacific Fishery Management Council, and the state of Hawaii. And it worked. It cooperated to get that data, that baseline data. We still don't have that quality of data for some of our reefs right here on Kauai. Even.
Well, let me back up on that
one, please.
Because that tripartite was focused on commercial fishing. That was the whole purpose of it.
Mm.
Now, when we started talking about the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands in 2000, it was more about conservation, not just about commercial fishing. And that's where it became a conflict.
Good point.
And I don't want to go through the story about how that happened, maybe at another time. But so it's a bit different. Everybody was on this paddling the canoe in the same direction. But in terms of the establishing the Marine National Monument, we still had people and agencies wanting to continue to fish there. They've already wiped out the lobsters. That's an obvious.
That was obvious to everyone.
Right.
And probably at the same time affecting monk seal pups. It was just a situation that needed to be corrected, and the monument really helped to establish the right way of dealing with that ecosystem, that very important ecosystem.
Can you give us some insights of how that monument, what actually was the catalyst that triggered that?
Yeah, there's a lot of people that did. Of course, there was 25,000 people that voted for it, even though NOAA and congressional delegation weren't really enthusiastic about it. But basically what happened was I got a grant from the University of Hawaii, $250,000 grant in 2000, and I was able to get it because I'm on this faculty at the University of Hawaii, and so I was able to get a grant. And we launched two expeditions to the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands in 2000 and 2001. And it was focused not just on the tripartite stuff, but to look at the whole system and try to look at the conservation value of these places. So I don't want to get into the details of what we did, but we published a 50-page color booklet, educational, and sent it out to everybody. So in 2003, Jean-Michel Cousteau got a hold of me and asked me to be his underwater guide. They wanted to do a movie, Voyage to Kure, in the Northwestern Hawaiian Islands. And Beth Flint was
Fish and Wildlife Service.
Ornithologist.
Ornithologist. So we were the two guides on this trip. It was in August of 2003, went all the way to Kure and stopped in. Since I'd been there many times, I wanted to make sure you got some good places to take video of. And so mission accomplished. Nothing happened for 3 years. It took them 3 years to get the film together.
Wow.
So when Jean-Michel finished it with his name, he went straight to Laura Bush, the first lady. Showed her that. She's a birder. She's a conservationist. Yeah. So she looked at this movie. So talk to George. George, we got to have an open house at the White House here. So they had the meeting. At that meeting, George Bush said, "I'm going to protect this place," period, and established the National Monument. Just slam dunked everybody.
So
it was unbelievable.
So we need to explain to our listeners a little bit about how the bureaucracies normally work in establishing a sanctuary or something like that. It goes through the agencies with recommendations of the biologists or not, and so forth.
That's the chain of command.
A national monument can be established by a president through executive order. Is that correct?
No, by an act. Actually, it is an executive order. 1906. Act. I forgot. Teddy Roosevelt actually was the one that started the whole thing. He started establishing all these national monuments without having to go through Congress.
Right.
So most of our national parks were established by, many of them were established by Roosevelt. And it's still, it's a lot more complicated now to do that, but it's the same act or executive order that allowed that to happen.
But that's very rare now. I mean, again, that's Teddy Roosevelt era that that normally that was utilized, right?
Well, wait a minute now. We've got three other national monument, Marine National Monument, established before I left. And I worked with the White House directly to try to establish what was important about it. And that's the Rose Atoll mm-hmm. Marine National Monument, the Pacific Remote Islands National Monument, and the Mariana Arch National Monument, Marine National Monument. So that's worked actually more than we might believe, and there might be more being established. But it's, this all through Bush administration.
Wow. There's again, we're so thankful that there have been heroes like you that have been working within and associated with our government. So thank you. And gosh, I guess we got to throw Bush a bone for something, right? That's fantastic.
And it's definitely Laura.
Yeah, right.
She actually came out here and did the dedication. And
right.
So she definitely deserves credit.
Now, the Northwestern Hawaiians obviously had been has been impacted severely by humans and had been overfished, obviously, in things like the lobster. But you've worked in many of these areas around the Pacific that have not necessarily had the type of human impact that even the Northwestern Islands have had. Can you give us an insight as to what's the biggest difference when you've had the opportunity to go out to some of these really remote reef systems compared to what we might see here on a reef off Poipu?
Well, that's it. It's hard to explain.
Yeah.
There's so many. Basically, the Pacific Ocean is the last frontier in the world here. And it's mainly because there's so many islands out there, some of them are small, that you really can't live on them, especially the dry atoll, say, in the Marshalls. And so they are really the last frontier. And it's just it's been a tremendous gift for me to be able to visit so many of them in the Pacific and to realize how important they are for us to try to protect them. And so for the last, since 2000, I've been trying to work with many agencies to establish more protected areas, especially on uninhabited atolls where the population is not an issue and politics, and because generally these places are in better shape. So I continue to do that, although I'm retired now. I am trying to establish additional initiatives in other parts of the Pacific where these places are still available. And I have to back up here on the Northwestern Island. It is a pretty pristine place. Mm-hmm. Aside from the fishing of the lobsters, I think it's in really excellent condition, and it is a very pristine place. And it's probably one of the oldest archipelagos in the world. In fact, I picked up a coral in 2006 that I couldn't identify, and I couldn't collect it because of the DLNR. So I held it in my hand and I put it back down, took lots of photos, and I had to go up. My dive buddy was already going up the line, so I just didn't know what to do. I did the right thing. I left it there. And it turns out it's probably a horn coral, which is something that went extinct 200 million years ago. The last known origin was Pennsylvania.
Wow. And you found a live one.
Looked like to be alive, but I can't prove it because I don't have this. And I wanted, if I'd have got some DNA from that. And so it could be that the hot spot where the Hawaiian Islands have formed might have been there before Pangaea split apart.
Wow, that is that. Most of our folks aren't going to understand that, but that's mind blowing.
Yeah. And it would be great if we could actually get this coral and date it in terms of its genetic drift.
Right.
It belongs in its own. It basically belongs in its own order.
Order.
Wow. That's profound.
But we'll never be able to know. The only way we're ever going to figure out how old the Hawaiian Islands are is to do something like that. Find a species that has lived for long, throughout the whole history, and then look at the genetic drift compared to what they are now.
Right. So, if you can, can you give us an idea of the difference between, let's say, if you can go into the snorkel off Poipu and you see some fish and you see some coral. So what if somebody got to go with you to Rose Atoll or somewhere?
Kingman Reef. Kingman Reef is about 1,000 miles, my favorite place. And the reason why it's safe, there's no land there, and there's no good charts for it. So nobody in their right mind is going to bring a boat there.
Because they don't even know how to find it.
If you get shipwrecked, there's no water, you die there.
So everybody avoids it.
Everybody avoids it. It's absolutely pristine. And the fish, the sharks, antheas, the small fish, and giant clams. There are thousands of giant clams. And anemones, it's pristine. It's beautiful. It's an amazing thing to be privileged to go to places like that. And
Wow. And then what about some of the other Pacific islands that are inhabited, right? How does the communities that live there, their relative impact on their coral systems compared to the Hawaiian Islands, let's say?
Well, in the Marshall Islands, there are about 30, there's more than 30 atolls there, but not all of them are inhabited. There's 7 or 8 that are not, and those could be established as protected areas. And we've been trying to work with that and work with the people there. But that's the urban centers of the Marshall Islands, Kiribati, American Samoa, where there's high population, then it's a problem, especially solid waste disposal, sewage discharges.
Right.
But there's still, you know, the populations are growing, but the islands are staying the same. So it's really important to try to establish protected areas for all the ones that are still uninhabited because there's not enough water on these islands. But at some point, somebody's going to come up with the idea of how to establish water in these places, and they're all going to be gone. So the time is running out here. We need to really make an effort to visit the entire, not only just the Pacific, but there's a few places in Southeast Asia and maybe especially in the Indian Ocean, the Chagos, to try to establish all of these protected areas if we can. There are as many as we can. Because this is our last chance to see a pristine coral reef before it gets overwhelmed by population growth and climate change or whatever.
So, go ahead, Don.
You know, Jim, when I look at places like Tutuila, American Samoa, where you've been many times, I look at, if you're in Pongo, the amount of plastics coming down the streams into the bay is just shocking. The coral reefs outside of the bay look pretty healthy, and yet the island community as a whole is forecasted to run out of fresh water by 2025.
Well, let's put this in perspective. This island is, 500 square miles? Tutuila,
it's tiny.
Is 72 square miles. Wow. And it's got as many more people
than
Kauai.
Oh, yeah.
So you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure out why we're running out of water.
Yeah.
Plus, there's very little flat land.
That's
there.
Right. It's very high mountains.
Everybody's living on the sides of the steep slopes of the island. And they're just going to have to move back to Hawaii or the rest of the United States. They are, of course, part of the United States territory. And so that's the only solution, really. There's going to have to be more opportunities.
The reason I brought up Tutuila as an example is we aren't that far here on Kauai, even though we're a bigger island. We don't have a good Gibbon-Hertzberg lens under the island of Kauai like Oahu has. Our ability to hold fresh water is minuscule compared to Oahu. And yet, for the most part, people look at the islands as having insatiable amounts of water, abundant, always abundant. Yet in 1982, it didn't rain anywhere on Kauai for 16 and a half months, not even on Mount Waialae. But back in 1982, we had half the people that we have now. If we would have had the population of Oahu in 1982, we would have had to bring in ships full of fresh water, or we wouldn't have water to drink.
Yeah, it's a big problem here. Well, in a sense, it's a blessing.
Right.
In disguise, yes.
Yeah.
It's a limit.
There's no limit how many people you can live here and just keep it that way.
So Jim, I'm really not much of a diver. I can snorkel, and you know, and I like to thumb through, you know, portfolios of reef photographs and stuff like that. So I like looking at cool marine critters as much as anybody else. But besides that, they look cool, right? What else could you share with our listeners about why they should be interested in coral reefs and supportive of their protection besides cool critters?
Well, I wanted to say one thing about that. There are some video, I think, I won't mention the company, but they're looking at virtual trips.
Oh, right.
Through the Pacific.
Dive trips to the Pacific. Mm. They're asking me for my photos. But one, I have tried to do this for my photographs. I'm an amateur photographer, and I've had a lot of my photos published, and I try to get the word out in that way. But they protect the shorelines of Hawaii. And there wouldn't be as many people living on Oahu. The whole Honolulu Plain is a coral reef that's sticking 20 feet up. And the reason why it's sticking up right now is because the Big Island, it's like sitting on a waterbed.
Right.
You got a gigantic
sumo wrestler
sits on the sitting bed. On a waterbed. So when it sits down there,
at one end,
the other part of it bulges out, and that's where Oahu is right now. And Kauai is sort of on the outside. So at some point in the future, and remember that the Big Island is only 300,000 years old.
Yeah.
It's still growing.
So it's still sitting down.
It's going to be moving up to the northwest. And when that happens, water level is going to increase, and so the only backup for that is going to be the coral reefs continuing to grow up around it. So it may be that when sea levels rise, there will be an opportunity for reefs to eventually. There'll be a lag between the time when that happens before they can actually establish. So coral reefs do protect the shorelines and actually create a considerable amount of land, both on Kauai and Oahu, as it is.
So the other thing I wanted to ask you that a lot of our listeners might be interested in, based upon your experience both in government and in kind of academia, is that how can people who are...
And the forest is gone.
In 100 years, more than half of the forests of the United States and one-third of all the soil of the United States was lost in 100 years between 1800 and 1900. I'm 15 years old reading this, and I said, holy smokes. That did more for me to understand the importance of conservation than anything. If I'm here, it's obvious that we didn't have our act together.
Right.
And we still don't. And this is so important. I mean, every other ecosystem and animal and plant basically are conservationists. They have to be.
That's right.
And it's just the human beings that are slow to understand that they just can't continue to live in a preferred lifestyle without taking into consideration the need for conservation.
Well, I think that's
well put.
That's profound. If one picture in one book could reach one person like you and the impact you've had on all our lives here in Hawaii, if we could reach 10 kids to have the same impact for future generations, we'd all be better off. Wow. And, Jim, I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing your experience and wisdom with us.
Well, thank you. It's been fun talking with you.
And mahalo, Jim.
Yep. And thank you again for being a hero in the government positions you've
not to everybody, but...
and thank you, Dean, again for engineering the show and making it available for us. Yep.
Ahui ho.
Ahui ho.
People coming,